Hello, everybody. My name is Bill Burke. I'm a JBoss fellow at the JBoss division of Red Hat, and today I'm going to talk to you about Practical EJB 3. So really, I'm going to talk about two different things in the EJB space. One, first, I'm going to talk about how certain aspects of EJB 3 allow you to develop applications easier. Then in the second part of the presentation, I want to talk about how in EJB 3 also makes it easier for framework developers to build frameworks. So not only is it easy, helps you, and it's easy for you to build applications, I want to show you how it helps you to build frameworks as well. Some of my qualifications. I've been a JBoss application server contributor since 2001. How many here use JBoss? Oh wow, a lot. That's cool. How about Hibernate? Oh yeah, all right. That's good. Yeah. It's a good story how I got involved with JBoss. I was at a small startup in the USA. We were using WebLogic from BEA, a demo license, a free license. And we were about to go live to our customer base, and our investors called us and said, hey, sorry guys, we're not gonna give you your funding, I'm sorry. We're about to go live, and at the same time, BEA comes to us and says, you guys, guess what? We're turning off your demo license. You have to pay us. Oh, we don't have any money to pay you. Oh, too bad. So what do we have to do? We had to move to JBoss. This is way back in 2001. We converted our application off of WebLogic, and that's really how I got involved with JBoss and eventually got hired by them in 2002. So I've been around JBoss since the very early days, since around 2001. I lead the EJB3 project at JBoss. I'm on the JSRs, the specification committees, EJB and Java Persistence, and the larger umbrella Java E specification. And also I'm a co-author of O'Reilly's EJB3 5th edition. And I believe that some of the conference is giving away, I think, 20 copies of the book. Yeah, I was really psyched. Last night I learned that it was actually translated into Polish. I was like, oh, wow, that's pretty cool. I was pretty excited by that. But my most important qualification of being here is that I am I'm of Polish descent. My 92-year-old grandmother, she's 100% Polish. Her maiden name is Stokowski. And her family's from the northeast of Poland, about 70 miles northeast of Warsaw. So I was really excited to come to Poland. Okay, so the first thing I'm going to talk about, how many people have used EJB 3 before? Okay, there's still a bunch. I'm not going to go into examples of how to write session beans or anything like that. What I'm going to focus on is some aspects of EJB you might not have heard about, like how it integrates with Java Persistence and how it makes it easier to use Java Persistence. So let's first talk about how EJBs allow you to interact with Java Persistence API and how it makes it easier to do that sort of thing. But before we do that, I want to give a little tiny overview of JPA. JPA stands for the Java Persistence API. It's new in Java EE 5. It's an object relational mapping Java classes to your database. For those of you who use Hibernate, it's really a standardization of Hibernate. Sun was really happy to get JBoss and the Hibernate folks like Gavin King involved with EE5. It gave a lot of energy to the specification. And what JPA allows you to do is map plain Java classes to a relational database. You can do the mapping through annotations or specified by XML. Here's a small example of that. Here we have just a, we want to map a customer class to a database. It's a plain Java class. This has properties, getter and setter methods. You can use a JDK 5 annotation. You say, hey, this is an entity bean. And this particular field here, this property ID, I want it to be my primary key that's stored in the database. And I want it to be automatically, the primary key to be automatically generated by the database. So that's a simple entity bean. I'm not going to go over the JPA specification. To actually store stuff in the database, because your entity bean classes are plain Java objects, you actually have to interact with a service. This service is called the entity manager. When you interface with entity manager, it allows you to manage entity bean instances. For those of you who are Hibernate users, it's very analogous. It's very much the same concept as a Hibernate session, same sort of idea. So entity bean instances, these plain Java objects that you're going to map to the database, they must be associated with an entity manager to be persistible. Otherwise, they're just plain Java objects. It's not like EGB2 or EGB 1.1 where an entity bean is a component. It's a heavyweight component. In JPA, entity beans are lightweight POJO objects that can be managed if you want to by a persistence engine. So when you work with entity beans, you want to associate them with a particular entity manager service. And this, when this happens, the entity manager actually watches the entity beans, and if they're changed, it manages changes that you make to the POJO and persists them to the database when you complete a transaction or you ask the entity manager to flush the changes to the database. So let's take a look at an example of using JPA standalone, because the JPA doesn't require you to have an application server. It can be used in regular Java applications. So the first thing you have to do is you have to get access to an entity manager factory. You do that through the persistence class that's available by all JPA implementations, and you say, hey, please create me a factory, and you pass it some configuration options, like what's the name of it, maybe some additional configuration tweaks you want to do at runtime. Then you have to ask, you have to say, factory, please create me an entity manager service. Again, this is like a session. You can almost think of it as can think about it like a JWC connection. So next thing we want to do, we want to create a customer and insert it into the database. So we just allocate that customer like you would any other Java object, and you set properties on that customer. Then you have to interact with the entity manager to actually persist this customer entity bean. You have to say, entity manager, please create me a local transaction. It's a lot like in JDBC when you get a JDBC connection, you want to do commit and rollback, that sort of things. Well, Entity Manager has the same sort of concept of local transactions. So Entity Manager, please begin a transaction for me. I want to persist this customer I just allocated. And finally, I want to commit what I just did. And you see we have a lot of try-catch blocks here to catch exceptions and roll back if there's an error. And we have to close our resources as well, because when you're working with entity managers, when you're creating them through a factory, they're a resource that consumes memory, consumes resources in your system. So you have, just like in JDBC, you have to close result sets, statements, and connections. You have to do the same thing in JPA. You have to close your entity managers and your references to entity manager factories. Otherwise, they leak memory. So. Yeah, that's great now, but it is a little painful to do that sort of thing. Even in JDBC, you have a lot of try-catch blocks to close your resources. So if you're actually using JPA standalone, it's a little painful to manage the life cycle of an entity manager and an entity manager factory. In your code, you have tons of try-catch blocks all over the place. If you guys write a lot of JDBC code, same sort of thing. You have a lot of try catch finally blocks to close your resources. As you saw, you have to manage your own transactions. You have to begin and commit them and roll back them. And if you're doing more than one tiny bit of persistence, let's say you have a bunch of services that you want to that interact with your database. If you want to do things in one transactional block of activity, you have to pass this entity manager you create, to pass it around off to all these other objects and functions that you're invoking. So this is where EJBs can make things, and the integration with EJB, the integration that EJB has with Java Persistence, this is how it can make things easier. EJBs can easily reference entity manager instances through Java EE's dependency injection. EJBs can manage the entity manager lifecycle for you, so you don't have to worry about that code yourself. Another cool thing that it does is it automatically associates entity manager instances with a JTA transaction, with a Java EE a heavyweight transaction, and it allows you to because it can associate entity managers with a transaction, it can propagate entity manager instances automatically throughout your transaction. So, but I'll talk about that in a little bit. So let's show a little example of how you can use JPA with EJB. Here's an example. What we're going to write here is a stateless session bean. It's a simple one. It's just we're going to call our customer registry, and it's really going to only have one business method that allows you to create a customer. In EJB 3, a stateless session bean can be really simple. All it needs to be is a plain Java class that implements an interface. You don't have to do anything else. You can annotate the class with @stateless. This tells the deployment runtime that this is a stateless bean that I want you to deploy, and it has to implement a simple business interface. And our business interface is customer registry, and this is a local interface rather than remote. It defaults to be just local. And when our clients interact with this customer registry, they're going to interact through this create customer method, which is implemented here. To actually reference an entity manager, all you have to do is use the persistent context annotation. You have a field in your stateless session bean. You say, "Hey, I want to when I invoke on the stateless bean, please inject me. Please set this field here to be an instance of an entity manager." In our create customer method, all we do is allocate our customer object and ask the entity manager to persist it. So the persistent context annotation gives us a reference to an entity manager. And EJB, by default, any business method you invoke is automatically invoked in a JTA transaction. So all that's done automatically for you. As you see, the life cycle of the entity manager is managed by EJB. There's no try-catch blocks here to close the entity manager instance. This is automatically done. This session management is automatically done by the EJB container. So this means that the EJB instance is created for a duration of a JTA transaction, and this session is destroyed at the end of the JTA transaction. Another cool thing is that this entity manager instance that's created for the duration of this transaction here, this entity manager instance is associated with the transaction. It's tagged to the transaction. So let's say in this method we called nested other, we had other EJB references that made up our system, and we invoked on those EJB references, and if they reference the same persistence context, they would get the same entity manager instance, and they can work with the same managed entity bean instances. And if you've used JBoss and our connection pooling, it's the same sort of idea. If you worked with our JDBC connection pooling, you'll notice that we have the same idea in JBoss, that a JDBC connection can be associated with a JTA transaction and propagated to nested EJB calls. On to my next topic. When you're working with JPA and EJBs, when you're working with them together, there's two types of entity managers. There's a transaction scoped entity manager, and something called an extended entity manager. A transaction scoped entity manager is what you've just seen in the previous example. The entity manager that gets injected into the stateless session bean lives and dies with the transaction. So it's created with the transaction and destroyed at the end of the transaction. So what does this mean, the entity manager is destroyed? What does it mean by that? Well, what happens is, if you remember what I told you before, entity beans are managed by the entity manager. They're watched by the entity manager. When the entity manager becomes destroyed, these entity beans just become regular POJOs, regular plain Java objects, and they're no longer watched by the persistent engine. So if you've modified these detached entity beans, changes will no longer automatically be persisted in the database. The other type of persistent context, other type of entity manager when you're working with EJBs is an extended entity manager. Extended entity managers are different in that they're not destroyed at the end of a transaction. This means that even if a transaction commits, the entity bean instances that you've worked with are still managed by and watched by the entity manager service. So they're not detached at the end of the transaction. When you're working with extended entity managers, they can only be injected into stateful session beans. They can't be used in stateless session beans because stateless session beans are pooled. Their life cycle isn't controlled by the user. So this means that when you work with an extended entity manager in a stateful session bean, these entity managers, their life cycle becomes tied with the stateful session bean's life cycle. So they're created when you create a new stateful session bean session, and they're destroyed when the stateful session bean is removed from memory. So let's show an example of that. So here we have a stateful session bean, a shopping cart bean. We annotate it with @stateful. And we say, hey, we want to inject an entity manager, but we want this entity manager to be extended. What does this mean? Well, let's say we call our business method setCustomer. We pass one of the parameters is name. We say, hey, I'm going to do a query on the database. I want to select the customer where the name equals what I passed in as a parameter. And I execute the query, and I store the result within a field in a stateful bean. Now, if you didn't have an extended persistent context, if you didn't have an extended entity manager, what would happen with this customer is that it would become detached and unmanaged from the entity manager. It would no longer be watched by the persistent engine. So if you made changes on it, it wouldn't automatically be persisted in the database. But since this is an extended entity manager, it's an extended persistent context, if I later on call the business method update address, that's its own separate transaction, and I set the customer's address, I change the customer's address, this change will automatically be persisted at the end of the transaction because this entity manager stays live for the duration of the stateful session bean. So that's a another nice feature that the EJBs have. Another cool thing about extended entity managers is a little known feature that EJB3 has. When you interact with an extended persistent context outside of a transaction, what happens is any updates, deletes, and inserts you do, they're actually queued until you actually interact with the extended entity manager within a transaction. So any updates you do will be queued and buffered in memory until you actually flush them to the database. Why is that cool? Why is that good in your applications? Well, let's say you had a web application. And the user interacts with the web application. Maybe they have to do 4, 5, 6, 7 steps before you actually want to commit stuff to the database. What you can do in each one of these pages is actually interact with the entity manager and have the entity manager do all the bookkeeping for you instead of you doing it yourself in your business logic. And then when you're ready to commit to the database, you can just say, hey, entity manager, just flush it to the database. So let me show you an example of that in action. We're gonna create a customer, create an order on our shop. We're gonna add to a shopping cart multiple times, then actually flush these changes to the database. So first thing we're gonna do is we have our stateful session being that's a shopping cart, and we wanna set what customer is interacting with our shopping cart stateful session being. We're gonna say, hey, this particular set customer method, I don't want to use it within a transaction. Don't start it. Hey, EJB container, do not start a transaction. That's what this annotation in red does. So we're gonna again query to see if the customer is in the database. If they're not, if the return value here is null, we're gonna create a customer and say entity manager persisted in the database. But since we're not in a transaction, this insert right here is not going to be put in the database at the end of the method call. It's just going to be queued up in the entity manager. Entity manager is going to bookkeep this and say and remember this this insert only locally inside the session, locally in memory. It's going to remember it. The next thing we do is we start shopping. So our client says, "Hey, shopping cart, I want to start shopping." So this method again is not invoked within a transaction. And you see here, we create an order and we set the order's customer to the customer we found before, and we say, "Entity manager, please persist this order." Again, because we're not in a transaction, that the creation of that order is going to be queued and buffered. It's not going to be flushed to the database. Then our client says, starts shopping around on the website, and they call one or more times the add to cart method. Again, we're not going to invoke this in a transaction, but what we're going to do is every time it's invoked, we're going to create an order entry entity being and add it to the order. So we're going to do all these updates and inserts multiple times with our interaction in the client, but we're not going to do it in the transaction. So the entity manager queues up all these inserts that we're doing in our shopping cart beam. Then finally, when the client is ready, when they want to actually commit these changes to the database, they call the checkout method. The checkout method is invoked in a transaction, and we just say, hey, entity manager, flush the changes to the database. So what's cool here is that the checkout method does not have any bookkeeping logic of what we've done prior when you've interacted with the shopping cart. So the entity manager does all the bookkeeping for you, and when you want to finish and actually flush these changes to the database, the entity manager is going to know what you've done. So it makes your code a lot simpler, a lot smaller. If you can buffer these updates and let the entity manager worry about the bookkeeping. And for those of you who've never used EJB3 and Stateful Beans, this is a side note here. Oops, what was that? This remove annotation. This says that after this method is completed, take this Stateful Bean and destroy it. End the session. So this is the summary of this section. So I want to show you a little bit how EJBs make it easier for you to write applications, specifically interacting with Java persistence. I showed you that EJBs provide nice persistent context management. They manage the life cycle of your persistent sessions for you. You don't have to do that sort of thing. I showed you how you can associate EJBs with a JTA transaction. And you can also do things like buffer inserts and updates. It's a nice way to make your applications easier. The next thing I want to step into is, so first we're talking about ease of use for application development. Next thing I want to talk about is ease of use for writing frameworks, for people that are actually building frameworks on top of EJBs to make things easier for application developers. What are interceptors? Well, interceptors are really a formalization of a concept that's been around in many application servers like JBoss. I mean, JBoss has had the concept of of Interceptors since the very beginning. So for a long time, Interceptors were only available in proprietary products specific to each vendor. So EJB3 came along and decided to standardize this particular feature. Interceptors can only be invoked on the server side, part of the server side. And what they allow you to do is if somebody invokes on an EJB, they allow you to intercept that method and do some special specific behavior. So they can intercept business methods. I'll show you later on that EJBs can also intercept lifecycle events like create, destroy, activate, passivate. They can intercept those events and do specific code. So what are the purpose of interceptors? What do you actually do with EJB interceptors? It's three things I want to talk about in this presentation. Really allows you to aspectize your applications. It's sort of a subset of aspect-oriented programming. A lot of the ideas behind that. I'll show you that you can actually write your own pluggable JDK annotations that have behavior within the EJB container. And what interceptors, what we wanted to bring in the EJB specification when we brought interceptors in, we wanted to start creating features that allow you to easily extend the behavior of the EJB container. So not only is our EJBs not so. We just didn't want EJBs to be easy to use. We wanted it to be easy for framework developers to implement new and innovative ideas in the framework space. Okay. So how do you write interceptors? First example I'm going to give is the idea of a really simple example. You probably would never do this, but it's a good way to illustrate how interceptors work. So here we have a stateless session bean. It's a data access object. And all it's doing, it's a bank account bean, and it's just interacting, babysitting our database. And we're coding along, we say, hey, I want to find out how long this method takes. How long does it take for this method to execute? So I go to my bank account bean Java class, and I add this code in red. At the beginning of the method, I get the current time in milliseconds, and then when the method finishes, I calculate how long the method took, and I just output it to the screen. So what's wrong with this example? What's bad about this example? One, the code becomes bloated. It becomes a lot bigger. This is because profiling logic, and profiling logic really has nothing to do with our business logic here. It has nothing to do with it. It's very different than the business application we're writing. It's difficult to enable and disable this profiling logic. So if I wanted to get rid of this timing logic here, I'd have to go into the Java class and comment out the code and recompile the system. And if I wanted to do it into other beans, I have to take this little code block here and copy, paste it around and recompile my application. Then finally, what's wrong with the example? It's impossible to extend profiling behavior transparently, because if you wanted to change the behavior of the profiler, if you wanted to do something a little bit different, we'd have to edit every single Java class that we had this profile logic in. Even though this profile logic would be the same across all of our business logic, we wouldn't have a nice one place to actually maintain and extend and reuse this implementation of profiling. This is where interceptors come to the rescue. What they provide you is a structure where none exists in object-oriented programming. They allow you to encapsulate the profiling logic in one Java class so that this profiling logic is easier to extend and easier to debug because it's in one place in your system. Then finally, it gives you, EJB interceptors give you a facility to transparently apply profiling logic. Gives you a nice way to attach an interceptor to an EJB class so that it's easy to disable and enable this profiling logic that we've implemented here. So the first thing we have to do is write an interceptor for our profiling logic. It's a Java class, and all it has to have in it is a method that is annotated with the around invoke annotation. The method name can be anything you want. Here, we're just going to call it profile, but it must match a certain signature. It must return a vanilla Java object, just a plain Java object. It must take a javax.interceptor.invocation context parameter, and it must throw an exception. So here, this logic looks very similar to what we wrote in our stateless bean. We're getting the current time in milliseconds, calculating how long the method took, and we're outputting the timing to the screen. So annotating a method with the around invoke annotation, what you're telling the EJB container is that you want to intercept an EJB business method. This interceptor is invoked in the same chain of other applied interceptors. So what it means is, and this interceptor here is in the same Java call stack as the bean method. This means, so if you have your bean method here, your interceptor really is wrapping around that bean method call, the EJB method call you're doing. And what this means, what I'll show you later, is that interceptors are actually allowed to catch exceptions thrown by the bean class, retry the invocations. They're allowed to do all these funky things. The invocation context object that you're passing as a parameter to the round invoke method. What this invocation context is it's an abstraction for an invoked bean method. It's really an abstract representation of the method you're actually invoking. It allows you to do things like get the EJB bean instance that you're invoking on. You can actually get the object instance you're invoking on. You can get a javalang reflect method object that gives you a generic abstract representation of the method. You can get and set the parameters of the method you're invoking. The generic representation is just an array of objects of the parameters that are being invoked on the EJB method. But the most important method there in the invocation context is the proceed method. You have to invoke when you're writing an EJB interceptor, you have to invoke the proceed method, because what the proceed method does, it tells the EJB container to either call the next interceptor in the chain or finally invoke the bean method. So the invocation context, you as a programmer have to drive the interception. The invocation context is responsible for going on to the next interceptor or calling the EJB instance at the end. So back to our profiling interceptor. You see here that, again, we get the time in milliseconds, and then we actually, invoke the underlying EJB method or the next method in the chain. So invocation.proceed does that. And you see we're returning the value of the proceed method, because the return value actually returns a javalang object representation of what the bean method returned, what the EJB method returned. So if the return is a void type, it'll return null. If it's an integer, just an int, it'll return the auto box representation of an int, an integer object, that sort of thing. So then at the end of the method in the finally clause, we get the current time in milliseconds, and we get the method, the javalang reflect method we're invoking on, and we print this out to the screen. We see, what's the string representation of the method, and this is how long the method took. Some details of interceptors. It runs in the same transaction and security context as the EJB method. So this around invoke method that gets invoked, it's going to be a transaction is going to already started if that bean is involved with the transaction, and you're going to have access to the security context as well. It supports interceptors allow you to do the same XML and annotation driven dependency injection that EJB3 and Java EE5 have, so you can access other parts of the environment in a Java EE environment. This is because it belongs to the same environment as the EJB it intercepts. So if your EJB has EJB refs, resource refs, environment entries, the interceptor can get access to these resources. The lifecycle of the interceptor. Interceptor instances that are instantiated at the same time as a bean instance. So if an interceptor intercepts a stateless session bean, it'll be created the same time the stateless bean instance is created, and it'll be pooled along with the stateless session bean. So there's a one-to-one relationship between the interceptor instance and the EJB instance. This means that it's destroyed when the EJB is destroyed, created when the EJB is created. And the side effect of this is that your interceptors can actually hold the same sort of state that your EJBs do. They're not just stateless entities. So let's evolve our profiler. So because we have this profiling logic in one class, we can start changing the behavior for it. We can refactor it. We can add new features. One of the features, let's say we wanted to, instead of just outputting this screen to the screen how long the method took, we want to actually log this into a local in-memory database maybe. And to be able to do that, we want to get access to an entity manager and to be able to persist it. And at the end of the method, we're going to say, hey, I want to create an entity bean that has the time it took to actually invoke the method and the method that was being invoked. And I want to get what principal was actually invoking this EJB by interacting with the EJB session context. Then finally, I want to persist it. We can refactor even further and into another different EJB that we reference inside the interceptor class. What I really wanted to show here in these two examples here, is that the interceptor can reference its environment. It can pull in references from the EJB's environment to be able to do its work. So it's not just a Java class that's intercepting a bean. It is part of the Java EE runtime and environment. Yeah, Java EE 5 introduces a lot of annotations, but in Java EE 5 and EJB 3, each annotation has an XML equivalent. And the XML equivalent of this example I just gave is really right here. You can declare your interceptors inside your EJB jar to XML. So here we're saying I have an interceptor class profiler interceptor. It's a round invoke method is profile. And it has these EJB references and environment entry references. So you can do all that stuff. Instead of using annotations, you don't have to use annotations because some people don't like them. You can use pure XML if you want to. But it's much easier to use annotations, a lot less you have to write. So we have this interceptor now. We have this profile interceptor. How do we actually apply it to an EJB? Well, there's three different ways you can do it. You can do an annotation. There's an interceptor's annotation that allows you to attach the interceptor to the bean, the EJB you're invoking on, or you can do it through XML. You can do it through explicit XML bindings, or you can have the concept of a default interceptor. So the first way to apply it is to use the interceptor's annotation. Here we are saying that because when we use the interceptor's annotation on the class, we have to pass in one or more interceptor classes that we want to be attached to the EJB. And this means that any bean method, any business method that we invoke here, the profile interceptor is going to be triggered for those methods. When you apply the interceptor's annotation to the class, you can apply more than one interceptor because the value parameter really takes an array. In every business method, it's intercepted, and they're executed. These interceptors are executed in the same order that they're declared in the annotation. Okay, I don't really like the interceptor's annotation because if you remember in the beginning, what did we not like about the profiling logic that we had embedded in our EJB? What we didn't like about it was that it was hard to turn it off and on. So and we just violated that principle here by attaching the interceptor within code. So my preferred way of applying an interceptor is through XML. And this is how you do that. Within your EJB jar to XML, in your assembly descriptor, you define an interceptor binding. You specify the EJB you want to intercept. You can have one or more interceptor classes that you want to attach to the bean, and that's about it. A side note here is that this particular blob of XML, it's actually complete. In EGB3, the schema for EGB jar to XML was changed so that you only have to have fragments of configuration that you wanna apply. So if you just want to add an interceptor, all you have to do in your EGB jar to XML is define the interceptor you want to add. If you want to change an EGB ref, override it in XML, all you have to do is define that little blob in your XML file, and you don't. So it's really configuration by exception, rather than having to define the whole huge XML file. Okay. So you can apply interceptors for the entire EGB class. Interceptors can be applied on a per method basis as well. And the way you do that is either you annotate the method or you define an XML binding. So let's show you that. Here we have two methods in our stateless bean now, a withdraw method and a debit method. We only want to do this profiling on our debit method, so what we can do is annotate our debit method with the interceptor we only want to invoke for this particular business method. Again, I don't like that. I prefer to do it in XML. So XML allows you to specify the method that you want to attach the interceptor to. Sometimes you have a framework of interceptors that you want to apply to your application, but you don't want to have to go to every single EJB and apply the interceptor, because then the XML you have to apply or the annotations you have to do are a lot more. So what you can do in your EGB jar to XML file, you can say, I want this interceptors or set of interceptors to apply to every EJB in the jar file. So you do that by using a wildcard in the EJB name. Okay. So that's applying interceptors. So how can interceptors do exception handling? Interceptors are allowed to abort an invocation. So if you're within an intercept, you can throw any exception you want. It usually should be a runtime exception, because if you throw a checked exception that doesn't match the method signature, you're going to get invocation target exceptions instead of the exception that you actually threw. You're allowed to catch and rethrow different exceptions. You can even catch an exception to bean method through and recover from it and retry the invocation, so you can do those certain things. So let's give some use. Let's start diving in to some use cases of using EJB. Some more examples. So let's give an example of aborting an invocation through an interceptor. Let's say we are a billing software vendor, and we want to provide customizable validation. We want to turn this validation on and off as needed. We want to be able to configure this validation through various EJB parameters. And we want to have an additional option of being able to, instead of just vanilla validation, we want to have users pay more for fraud detection. And what we can, to make it easier to sell and package our product, we're going to use interceptors to apply this behavior. So here's an example of a simple validation. When we do withdraw, we want to have a maximum amount you can withdraw from your bank account. We're going to get this maximum amount, this configurable amount from an environment entry. And our interceptor is going to do is going to look at the withdraws parameter and see if it's greater than the maximum amount we've configured and abort the EJB invocation if the amount is greater than what we've configured it for. And then we can configure the maximum amount you can withdraw with an XML file. Another thing we could do is we could write our own custom security engine. Let's say we wanted to have our security, our pluggable security mechanism, we actually wanted to look at the content of a method and determine whether or not the user is authorized to invoke the method. So you can do things like that because the interceptor, again, can abort the invocation before it actually gets to the EJB method. So in an interceptor, you can actually write your own custom security that goes above and beyond what Java EE defines. So another thing you can do is something that Spring does. It has the idea of an exception hierarchy for SQL exceptions. The idea is that if you have a SQL exception that's thrown by JDBC, instead of looking at the error number and matching it to the vendor's error codes, what you do instead is you define a hierarchy of exceptions that extend SQL exception and that tell you that each of these sub exceptions are defined to a specific database error. So here's an example of interceptor doing that. The interceptor could catch SQL exception, look at the error code of the SQL exception. So let's say Oracle's error number for a deadlock exception is 3344, and what the interceptor could do is allocate a new SQL exception, deadlock exception, and throw that to the application. So this would allow our clients to actually catch specific error conditions in their code and not worry about the specific error numbers of each database vendor. Okay. So that's interceptors in exception handling. Another thing that interceptors can do besides intercepting methods, they can actually intercept lifecycle events of the EJB container. For instance, they can intercept the post construct, the EJB create method that's done on the EJB. When you want to intercept a lifecycle event, it's the same signature as a round invoke, except that instead of using the round invoke annotation, you use the same lifecycle annotation. So instead of actually showing to be able to visualize this, let's do a really simple example here. For example, Java EE 5 has no annotation that allows you to inject directly from global JNDI. So let's write one. So what we're going to do is we're going to create a new annotation, our own custom annotation called Jindy Injected, and we're going to use it to be able to inject something from global JNDI. So this is what it's going to look like. When in our stateless beam, we're going to have a field, and we're going to be able to annotate it with Jindy Injected, specifying the Jindy name we want to inject into the application. So the first thing we have to do is define the annotation in regular Java. So here we have our Jindy, we write our Jindy injected annotation. We say, hey, it's only applicable to a field, and we need to make this annotation visible at runtime so that our interceptors can look at the annotation. And the value of the annotation is going to be the Jindy name we want to inject into the field. Next thing we have to do is intercept the post construct event of the EJB instant that's being created. For those of you who are not familiar with EJB 3, post construct is the same thing as EJB create, the same lifecycle callback. So an interceptor, what we're going to do is we're going to define again a method that takes the invocation context parameter, and we're just going to annotate with post construct. This tells the EJB container that this interceptor is going to intercept the EJB create event, this post construct event. In the injector method, we're going to get access to the initial context, the Jindy initial context. We're going to ask the invocation context for the EJB instance we're invoking on. From that EJB instance, we're going to get the class, the type of the EJB, and we're going to do reflection on it. We're going to introspect it. We're going to say, hey, what are your fields? What are the fields of the class? If this field is annotated with Jindy injected, I want to look up the value in JNDI and then use the reflection API to set that field's value to what we found in JNDI. So really simple. We can write our own custom injection annotation by implementing it as an interceptor. Then finally, we can apply this interceptor by by using an interceptor binding in their EDB jar XML file. So a summary of some of these use cases. You can apply orthogonal behavior transparently. You can do, like, our method profiler was an example of that. You can do things like aspectizing your exception handling, so you can do things like validation, fraud detection, your own custom security, JDBC wrappers, that sort of thing. And then finally, I showed you how you could do your own custom injection annotations. So those are theoretical uses of EGB interceptors. EGB interceptors are actually being used in the industry, specifically at JBoss. We're using them specifically in three different applications. One is the business activity service. There are interceptors that provide compensating transactions. And Machi Mahulak, is he here? Hey, how's it going? He's a JBoss guy, and he's actually going to present on this in this conference. It's a really cool service. You should check out his presentation. Another way we use EGB interceptors is we have in our JBoss Spring integration, and JBoss Seam, a new project by Gavin King that was started up about a year ago. It heavily uses EGB interceptors to apply seam behavior. So, for instance, the JBoss business activity framework, what it allows you to do is it has the concept of a long-running business activity, and transactions in this environment are really committed each time you invoke on them. And what they, instead of a rollback, they have the idea of an undo rather than a rollback. And Mr. Mahulak's framework allows you to annotate an EJB and say, hey, if I want to undo a booking of a hotel reservation, this is how it's compensated. It's compensated by the cancel method. But he'll dive more into that, how his framework interacts with business activity. Our EJB Spring integration, allows you to define your bean classes. And your bean XML file in Spring and jar it up and actually deploy it to the system without any writing any bootstrapping. But to get access to those particular beans, you can actually inject Spring beans directly into directly into fields of your EJBs. So if you want to integrate EJB with Spring, we have some nice annotations that allow you to gain access to Spring beans. Then finally, JBoss Seam. JBoss Seam has its own special custom injection annotations. Seam allows you to use EJBs as controllers in an MVC environment in a web application, so your stateless session beans can be controllers. And Seam has annotations that allow you to access access attributes in the HTTP session. They're in the in annotation and out annotation. What this is saying to the EJB container is that when I invoke this action method here, I want to pull in the model object from the HTTP session. So it gives you a nice way to access things in the HTTP session so that your EJBs can actually become controllers in an MVC environment. So that's about it for things in the real world. And this is the end of my presentation. Hopefully you're not asleep. Who's asleep? Anyway, what I discussed about in this section is that interceptors allow you to encapsulate really cross-cutting concerns. If you think about it even further, interceptors are very really a subset of aspect-oriented programming. I showed you that interceptors allow you to write your own frameworks, and it's actually being used in the industry by companies like JBoss. And a shameless plug, I'm the author of Enterprise Java Beans 3.0, and I believe they're giving Polish versions away. I think the end of the day. I don't know when. So that's about it. There's a lot of cool presentations today. I already talked about Maciej's presentation on business and activity. I also know Jonas Bonner. We've been competitors for a long time, and I have a lot of respect for the work he's done. He's got a really cool presentation on caching and his products. So it should be a good day for you guys. Should be a lot of fun. Thanks a lot.
Dwight.